less than nothing, borrowing from the future. Interlude 4. Borrowing from the future, changing the past. In his wonderful Le Plagiat par Anticipation, Pierre Bajard developed in detail the idea that writers can plagiarize not only works from the past, but also works from the future. The accusation of plagiarism is grounded on a resemblance between two works which is so strong that it cannot be dismissed as a mere coincidence or a sharing of the same style. So when we have two works from different periods which very closely resemble each other, what is the key argument for taking this as a paradoxical case of the earlier work plagiarizing the not yet existing work from its future, and not, as in the standard approach, treating the latter as plagiarizing the former? Bajard proposes the criterion of dissonance. If we can clearly establish that, in relation to the features shared by the two works, the later one contains these features in a more fully developed form, while the earlier one contains only undeveloped fragments which do not fit into the totality of the work, will appear to strike a dissonant tone, or if this work itself, as a whole, strikes a dissonant tone in its own cultural context, then we can assume with reasonable certainty that the earlier work is a plagiarism of the later one. Among other amusing references, like a passage from Voltaire's Zadig, which clearly points forward to Sherlock Holmes's method of deduction, Bajard's great example is from a lesser-known novel by Guy de Maupassant, which contains an uncannily Proustian passage on how a contingent encounter with an everyday object can trigger a multiplicity of half-forgotten memories about the past. This novel was written 3 decades before Proust began to publish his great cycle, and the passage is clearly out of sync with the rest of the novel. So it really is as if Maupassant plagiarized Proust, as if, in a weird rupture of the linear temporal continuum, a door into the future momentarily opened up, giving Maupassant a glimpse into what lay ahead in literature. There is an uncanny moment of plagiarizing the future in Hitchcock's work. Vertigo contains an enigmatic episode in which Madeleine is seen by Scotty as she opens a window and then inexplicably disappears from the house. Does this scene not point forward to Psycho, to the appearance of the mother's silhouette in the window? In both cases, a body appears out of nowhere and disappears back into the void. The fact that in Vertigo this episode remains unexplained tempts one to read it in a kind of futur antérieur, as already pointing towards Psycho. Is not the old lady who is the hotel clerk of the house in Vertigo a kind of strange condensation of Norman Bates and his mother, the clerk, Norman, who is at the same time the old lady, mother, thus providing in advance a clue to their identity, which is the great mystery of the film? The question which immediately arises here is, of course, how seriously we should take these claims. Surely not too seriously, since, in this case, we would have to embrace the New Age topic of synchronicity and mystical communion between spirits from different epochs, able to converse with each other in an eternal present. Nonetheless, the idea of a plagiarism by anticipation should not be dismissed as a mere provocation. Still less so does it imply any kind of a hidden teleology in which the present points towards a future determined in advance. On the contrary, the idea is profoundly anti-teleological and materialist. All that needs adding to it is the key concept of retroactivity. Italo Calvino's story, A Beautiful Day March, A Beautiful March Day, offers an idiosyncratic description of the conspiracy against Julius Caesar. Calvino focuses on the unintended consequences of the act of killing Caesar, While the conspirators' intention was to kill a tyrant and thereby restore Rome to its republican glory, their act effectively abolishes the very conditions which sustained its intended meaning, as Molly Rothenberg explains. The very world in which it made sense to get rid of Caesar also vanishes with those dagger strokes, not because Caesar held that world together, but because the assassins could not foresee that their act would also transform the way the act would be judged. They could not factor in the historicity of their action. Neither they nor anyone else could predict or govern how the future would interpret the assassination. Put another way, we could say that there simply was no way for them to take into account the retroversive effect of future interpretations. Here we encounter the key feature of the symbolic, the fundamental openness it introduces into a closed order of reality. Once we enter the symbolic, things never simply are. They all will have been. They, as it were, borrow part of their being from the future. Rothenberg employs a simple example of a tender statement. Carl smiled as he gently stroked the velvety skin of his lover, which continues with a supplement that brutally changes the meaning of the first part, with the keen edge of a steak knife. The cause of this irreducible openness of the symbolic is not its excessive complexity. We never know into what decentered context our statement will be inscribed, but the much more refined, properly dialectical impossibility of taking into account the way our own invention will transform the field. The speaking subject cannot take into account the way it is itself counted in the signifying series. With regard to its own inclusion, it is irreducibly split, redoubled. How, then, to resolve this enigma without resorting to New Age obscurantism? The key is the properly dialectical notion of repetition through which things become what they are. Maupassant becomes a plagiarist in advance of Proust. He becomes what he is, a Proustian avant la lettre. Only once Proust arrives in Hegelese, the shift is from in itself to for itself. Through his repetition in Proust, Maupassant retroactively becomes Proustian. This means that we have to introduce a radical split between Maupassant's book as it is in itself and his book as it is when read retroactively, after Proust. In other words, the fact of Proust's text generates another Maupassant, the Proustian one. We are thus dealing with three and not two texts here: Maupassant's original novel, Proust's cycle of novels, and the Proustian Maupassant. But why talk like this? Why not simply say that Proust influences our reading of Maupassant? Because such a retroactive reading does not simply add another dimension to how we receive Maupassant. Rather, we need to grasp Maupassant's text as not all, as open towards the future, as full of gaps and inconsistencies waiting to be filled in. Bajard himself retreats here with regard to his own theory when, in an all too naive way, he tries to outline the future Kafka was plagiarizing by anticipation. What should make us suspicious of his attempt is the image of Kafka's universe to which he refers, the boring standard image of Kafka as the precursor of 20th century totalitarianism, an oppressed individual exposed to the whims of arbitrary power, etc., invoking the even greater oppression of women described in Kafka's text. Bajard engages in a ridiculously politically correct speculation that Kafka had plagiarized a future, not yet written, novel about an oppressed Muslim woman. This is Bajard at its worst, ignoring all the profound ambiguities concerning the role of women in Kafka's text. They are not only servants, but also corrupted with lust, helping those in power to harass the hero. As Reinhard Stach demonstrated long ago, Kafka's image of women is deeply indebted to Otto Weininger, the ultimate anti-feminist and anti-Semite, In outlining his ridiculous proposal, Bajar ignores his own basic rule. Instead of looking for dissonances in Kafka's work, he simply extrapolates the contours of the future work from the standard clichés about Kafka. The great dissonances in Kafka's work are constituted by his animal stories about dogs and so forth, which clearly stand apart from the cliché image of the hero caught up in a totalitarian machine. Among them, one should especially focus on the very last literary text he was writing while close to death, the story about the singing mouse, Josephine. In this dissonant image of the role of the artist in a communist society, we find a woman of the future different from all the corrupted, seductive heroines from Kafka's great novels. Another version of the same retroactive mechanism is at work in cases where a substantial decision involving the rise of a new master signifier, which rearranges the agency's entire symbolic economy, is taken and then undone, like sending a letter which commits me to a new relationship, and then, when I discover that the letter was lost in the post, reneging on the commitment. A case of undoing can be found in Two Lovers, James Gray, 2008, a film loosely based on Dostoevsky's White Nights, which takes place in the Russian-Jewish part of the Brighton Beach suburb of New York. The hero, Leonard, emotionally unstable, makes several unsuccessful suicide attempts, acts, and then changes his mind. At the start of the film, he jumps into the water in an attempted suicide, then changes his mind and surfaces to be helped by a passerby. He is split between two women. His parents set him up with Sandra, the daughter of their potential business partner, who is loving and caring but conventional. The other woman is Michelle, his outrageously daring and unconventional new neighbor. When he learns that Michelle is dating Ronald, a married partner in her law firm, he tries to break all contact with her and becomes more deeply involved with Sandra. However, when a desperate Michelle calls him from the hospital where she is being treated for a miscarriage, they become attached again. Disappointed with Ronald for not helping her enough in her distress, Michelle informs Leonard that she has broken off the relationship and is going to San Francisco. Deciding to go with her, Leonard buys two tickets online, purchases an engagement ring, and packs for his trip. At a party the next day, Sandra's father, believing that Leonard is planning to marry Sandra, offers him a partnership in the soon-to-be-merged family businesses. Leonard ducks out to meet Michelle, who tells him that she is not going to San Francisco after all, because Ronald has left his wife and will marry her. Distraught, Leonard goes to the beach to kill himself. However, as he steps in the ocean, he drops a glove that Sandra had bought for him earlier. Picking it up, he returns to the party and gives Sandra the engagement ring he bought for Michelle. The movie deals with the standard theme of the choice between a secure, emotionally stable marriage and a wild, passionate bond destined to end in catastrophe. It is a choice between happiness and what Lacan calls jouissance, excessive enjoyment beyond the pleasure principle, with the underlying implication that, against the excess of jouissance, hedonism, the reign of pleasure, and law, in the narrower sense of public morality, are on the same side. To be able to put everything at risk and jump into the unknown waters of a passionate affair requires an act which may irreparably change the most basic coordinates of a subject's life. However, the true interest and originality of the plot lies elsewhere, in the precise temporality of the hero's decision and its retroactive cancellation. After making the fateful decision, the choice of Michelle, and thus apparently reaching the point of no return, Leonard learns that his decision has been rendered meaningless. Michelle is no longer available, and so undoes it. Since Sandra knows none of this, Leonard just acts as if nothing has happened, as if there was no decision, and even opportunistically gives her the ring meant for Michelle. The appearance of a smooth and seamless relationship with Sandra is restored. To get at the core of this situation, we can imagine three different versions of the same plot. Three what ifs. 1. What if, even after learning that Michelle will return to Ronald, Leonard were to stick to his decision and drop Sandra, in recognition of the authenticity of his love for Michelle? Perhaps this would have been a true act. 2. What if, after the decision is taken, Leonard is overcome with anxiety as he becomes fully aware of the consequences of his act? In a panic, he would then desperately search for a way out and find that he can undo the decision, retroactively erasing its traces. The difference with the film plot is that in this version, he undoes the act not because Michelle dropped him, but of his own accord. 3. Finally, what if, secretly knowing about Leonard's distress and his commitment to Michelle, Sandra helped him by feigning ignorance? Let us imagine that Leonard had written Sandra a letter informing her of his decision to leave with Michelle, but Sandra pretended that she missed the letter, thus giving him the chance to undo his mad decision with grace and without a scandal. Such an act of ignoring, of pretending not to know, is what is usually referred to as wisdom. The circular relationship between the future and the past that we encounter here goes all the way down to the very emergence of the speaking subject out of the human animal. In Lacan's account of this emergence, it sometimes appears that the primordial fact is the encounter with the symbolic order, the parasitic intrusion of the signifier which upsets the balance of the human animal, introducing a gap into it, engendering a pathological excess of undead life over mere biological life. Sometimes it appears that it is, on the contrary, the derailment of life itself, the emergence of a traumatic excess of more than life, which is the primordial fact, and the symbolic order's function is rather to normalize and tame this excess. The solution to this alternative is retroactive causality. The excess of life comes first, but it can be recognized as such only retroactively, once the symbolic order is already there. Without this after effect, the excess of life is merely a natural accident. On the first approach, it may appear that the first account is the idealist one. The signifying order intervenes into animal life from a mysterious outside, like a hand of God imparting spirit into bodies. While the second narrative is the materialist one, the disturbance of material biological life comes first. The symbolic order arises as a secondary defense mechanism. However, the properly Hegelian, that is, dialectical materialist solution is more complex as it involves retroactivity. True, there is first an excess, a derailing, of the natural circuit of instincts. However, this derailment is confirmed as the foundation of being human, as its inhuman core, only by its effect, by the rise of the symbolic order which endeavors to normalize it. Without the symbolic order, the excess remains an aberration of nature, a meaningless freakish accident. The search for this pure excess of life, not yet contaminated / obfuscated by the symbolic order, is thus a mythical search for a phantasmatic entity. It is not that such a search is condemned to failure. We may well succeed in isolating this excess, but there would be nothing human about it. It would be just a meaningless deformation. We encounter here yet again the innermost paradox of the symbolic order, namely its retroactivity. The symbolic order is not a cause which intervenes from the outside, violently derailing the human animal and thus setting in motion its becoming human. It is an effect, but a paradoxical effect, which retroactively posits its presupposition, its own cause. This temporal paradox holds even more strongly for the relationship between a literary text and real life. In his Tomorrow is Written, written before plagiarizing the future, Bajar prefigures the analysis of the later book. Focusing on those literary texts in which the author seems to predict his own future, especially the mode of his death. Here it is not a future text which is plagiarized, but reality itself which is not plagiarized, but described before it has happened. Note how in Bajars's own case the later book seems to precede the earlier one. Apart from the obvious case of Oscar Wilde, who, in his picture of Dorian Gray, displayed an uncanny awareness of the catastrophe which awaited him years later, the most interesting example here is Jack London's Martin Eden, with its description of the writer's suicide by drowning. A weird case of an autobiography which stretches into the writer's future. An author usually writes his autobiography in old age, when his life has come full circle, recapitulating his trajectory from the perspective of maturity, which allows him to see it in its totality, assigning each event to its proper place. The extraordinary thing about Martin Eden, a novel but clearly an autobiographical one, is that Jack London wrote it in the middle of his life, at the height of his success and creative powers. At this point, instead of ending in the present, he did not stop, but courageously went on, continuing his life story into the future right up to its tragic end. Perhaps a little prematurely, Bajar opposes his approach to that of psychoanalysis, which sees the roots of the present narrative in the reel of a past trauma which can only be described and may even be constituted après coup, retroactively. Here, by contrast, the trauma lies not in the past but in the future, from where it mysteriously casts its shadow over the present writing. In his conceptual elaborations, which follow the analysis of literary cases, Bajar proposes two new grammatical temporal categories in order to account for such strange occurrences: the past to come in the future, and the future which already happened in the past, that is, which belongs to the past. What, then, changes in the passage from the real of an accident to its inscription into a narrative as a part of the subject's fate? The real accident is purely contingent, while its symbolic inscription into a life narrative makes it not so much necessary as an expression of the subject's will. Even if the future is that of a terrifying catastrophe, the subject wills it in the sense of willingly accepting the coming catastrophe, of freely assuming its necessity. Bajar is not a spiritual obscurantist when he talks about the future being already written. He is not invoking some kind of divine big other able to see across time into the past as well as the future. On the contrary, he emphasizes human finitude and contingency, which means that the gap between the symbolic narrative and the real is irreducible. The future that has a retroactive causality on the present can also not happen, due to some totally unforeseen contingency. What then happens with the events, and which is the world that is sufficiently generous to gather them, for which the writing shows that they should have been produced, but which were in the last moment stopped in their path towards realization? The life of Kafka, the very symbol of the precursor, bears witness to how an entire human existence can be organized in such a way that it points towards an event which should take place, but is finally thwarted. The future real which causes its present literary registration, inverting the proper temporal order so that the future cause precedes its effect, the present narrative may be a catastrophe that will befall the author, death, social disgrace, etc., but may also be a happy culmination of his efforts. The subject, author, can thus relate in two ways to the future event. He can fully engage in bringing it about, in realizing his fate, but be thwarted by what appears as, but may not be, a pure external contingency, or aware of his fate as the catastrophe awaiting him at the end of the path. He works desperately to thwart or at least postpone its arrival. until, as in the well-known twist of the Oedipus myth or the appointment in Samara, he discovers that the very effort to avoid his fate ensures that it will actually be realized. This basic temporal paradox of the symbolic order, its borrowing from the future, or how the goal towards which our activity is directed does not precede it but emerges through this very activity of trying to reach it, brings us back to Hegel, to the link between intention and act, which lies at the core of his literary references. One of the enigmas of Hegel's phenomenology is how, in roughly the middle of the book, there is a sudden surge in references to literary examples, which had been absent up to that point. Alan Speight was right to identify as the key factor the topic of agency, of the subject as an autonomous agent who has to justify its act with reasons and then assume their unexpected consequences, and the narrative, the story told in literature or in a theatrical piece, is ultimately always the drama of the subject's action, relating the subject's painful or ridiculous tragic or comic experience of the unintended consequences set in motion by his action. A story is the story of things gone wrong, of intervening to achieve A and getting B. This is why literary references arise not only in the long section on spirit, the quantitative and qualitative center of the entire book, but already in the preceding section on reason, with its second division on the actualization of rational self-consciousness through its own activity, which follows the weird climax on observing reason, the notorious subdivision on physiognomy and phrenology. As Speight perceptively notices, the passage is announced in Hegel's brief reference to Hamlet's meditations on Yorick's skull. In contrast to the section on phrenology, where the skull as a dead object in its immediate material being is supposed to provide the key to the human mind, Yorick's skull is for Hamlet a self-erasing sign, a reminder of all the past acts and experiences of the dead subject. The three main figures from literature that are then referred to are Goethe's Faust, Schiller's Karl Moor, and Cervantes's Don Quixote. In all these cases, it is as if spirit casts its shadow backwards onto the chapter of On Reason. The literary references contained in the latter point forward towards their proper form in spirit. In other words, at the level of reason, we do not yet have a proper spiritual substance, a historical totality which exists as an actual form of life, but just abstract forms of subjective life, forms which can appear within different historical epochs. It is only with spirit that the succession of figures, shapes of consciousness, reproduces the succession of actual historical formations from Greek antiquity through Rome and the medieval self-alienation of spirit up to the struggle of the Enlightenment against belief, the French Revolution and the post-revolutionary morality of the emerging bourgeois order. In short, the section on spirit is Hegel's first systematic exposition of a philosophy of history. The inner structure of the section on spirit is, as expected, triadic. It starts with the ancient Greek substantial order of customs, Sittlichkeit, and the reading of Antigone confronts us with the subterranean antagonism, which leads to the collapse of this order, to the split of its substantial unity into abstract individuals opposed to the alienated objectivity. The next stage, culture or self-alienated spirit, deals with the painful process of the subject's gradual overcoming of this alienation through the hard work of Bildung, of the self-sacrificing education destined to elevate the subject to the level of universality. To become a universal subject reconciled with substance, one has to renounce any direct identification with the particular nature of one's identity. The reading of Diderot's Rameau's nephew then shows how the self-renouncing sacrifice of serving a noble cause shifts him to a different self-alienation, the sacrifice of one's ethical substance itself in the vain flattery of the monarch. The logic is again that of the imminent self-relating reversal. One begins with a sincere readiness to sacrifice everything for the honor of serving a noble cause, and one ends by sacrificing this cause itself, of losing the honor itself. Finally, the third part describes the post-revolutionary spirit certain of itself, the rise of the Kantian subject who directly knows itself as the bearer of the universal moral law. This direct identification with the universal again leads to an antagonism, the conflict between the acting subject who, as is the case with every act, imposes on objectivity its partial project, and the judging subject who condemns the acting subject, the beautiful souls, but whose position is no less unilateral and false. The judging subject refuses to see how he participates in the corrupted world he so vigorously condemns. As Hegel deploys it through implicit references to Rousseau, the new Heloise, and Jacobi, not his philosophical works, but his novels. Evil is also in the eye of those who perceive evil everywhere around them. Speight develops in detail how each of the three epochs has its own literary genre, which articulates the core of its socio-ethical antagonism, Greek tragedy, Roman, and an early modern comedy, the romantic novel, as well as a notion which formulates the lesson of this antagonism. The lesson of the antagonisms which leads to the hero's tragic fate in Greek drama is the imminent retrospectivity of the true meaning of our acts, or as we would put it today, moral luck. It is only retrospectively through accomplishing the act that the subject becomes aware of its true dimension, and of its own true motivations for accomplishing it. The lesson of comedy is the inherent theatricality of our social lives. Every act is acting. Even when we think we, just are who we are, we act ourselves. We play a socially mediated role. And finally, the lesson of the romantic novel concerns evil and its forgiveness, namely the possibility of reconciliation. While in Greek tragedy, reconciliation was only possible in the guise of amor fati, as the tragic heroic acceptance of fate. The romantic universe opens up the possibility of resolving the conflict not with the agent's destruction, but with the mutual reconciliation between the agent and its judge, both sides admitting their fatal limitation. We can now also see how referring to literature is an imminent part of the Hegelian procedure. The way Hegel undermines a certain shape of consciousness is by first presenting it in itself, in its abstract notion, the way it perceives itself as a consistent socio-ethical project, and then problematizing it, not by measuring it against a pre-existing higher standard, nor by submitting it to abstract logical analysis which would unearth its contradictions, but by staging it as a concrete stance of subjectivity in a historical life world. In today's terminology, Hegel is not interested only in logical contradictions, but more so in pragmatic contradictions, in the tension between what we claim we are doing and what we are actually doing. Antigone describes what happens when a subject effectively acts upon the premises of the ethics of immediate substantial customs, and thereby brings out the inconsistency of this ethical figure, the inconsistency which leads to its self-destruction. The reference to Antigone provides a model of Hegel's reading. He begins with Antigone before her act of disobedience to Creon's prohibition. Her starting point is a simple substantial ethical awareness that there are higher, or rather deeper, laws than the public laws of the city, laws which are irrational, coming from nowhere, but nonetheless have to be obeyed unconditionally. Zeus did not announce those laws to me, and justice, living with the gods below, sent no such laws for men. I did not think anything which you proclaimed strong enough to let a mortal override the gods and their unwritten and unchanging laws. They're not just for today or yesterday, but exist forever, and no one knows where they first appeared, so I did not mean to let a fear of any human will lead to my punishment amongst the gods. But once she engages in the forbidden act, performing the funeral rite for Polynices, and faces the consequences, the threat that she will die while still alive, only then does she become aware of the actual rule that guided her. What law do I appeal to, claiming this? If my husband died, there'd be another one, and if I were to lose a child of mine, I'd have another with some other man. But since my father and my mother too are hidden away in Hades's house, I'll never have another living brother. That was the law I used to honor you. How are we to read this descent from the highly principled appeal to universal, eternal, unwritten laws to the apparently contingent and prudential reasoning, which refers to quite precise, particular, pragmatic considerations? These scandalous lines, which have bothered interpreters up to and including Judith Butler, Goethe and many others even suggested they must be a later intrusion, are crucial for the concrete universality Hegel is aiming at. For a sister, the brother is the particular which directly stands for the universal. He is a pure other, not marked by any sexual or power interest, and love for him is pure love. It is this anchoring of her persistence in the figure of the brother that provides Antigone with the highest intuition of ethical essence, and it is crucial that Antigone was able to formulate this insight only after she accomplished her act. Only then did she become aware of what she had done, of what had really motivated her. There is no prior goal or norm, which is merely executed in the act. We should not read this retroactivity as Antigone simply becoming aware of what was already there in her unconscious, of what unconsciously she always already knew. Such a reading merely moves the pre-existing goal slash norm into the unconscious, but in a more radically decentered fashion. The very norm that effectively guided her comes to be only through its actualization, for the act generates its own norm. The passage from intention to act is the passage from the abstract universality of the law. Respect for the dead, they all deserve funeral rites, to the concrete universality which exposes the particular content that sustains the universality of the law. At the level of speech, this means that our thought, our intention to mean what we want to say, is dependent on the process of its expression. I discover what I want to say only by saying it. In today's cognitive sciences, this dependence of thought on the linguistic process of its articulation was most clearly pointed out by Daniel Dennett, who quotes Lincoln's famous line, "You can fool all the people some of the time, and some of the people all the time, but you cannot fool all the people all of the time," drawing attention to its logical ambiguity. Does it mean that there are some people who can always be fooled, or that on every occasion someone or other is bound to be fooled? His point is that it is wrong to ask, what did Lincoln really mean? In all probability, Lincoln himself was not aware of the ambiguity. He simply wanted to make a witty point, and the phrase imposed itself on him because it sounded good. Here we have an exemplary case of how, when the subject has a vague intention to signify and is looking for the right expression, as we usually put it, the influence goes both ways. It is not only that among the multitude of contenders the best expression wins, but some expression might impose itself which changes more or less considerably the very intention to signify. Is this not what Lacan referred to as the efficacy of the signifier? The thought itself formulates itself through the process of its articulation. We don't first apprehend our experience in the Cartesian theater and then, on the basis of that acquired knowledge, have the ability to frame reports to express. The emergence of the expression is precisely what creates or fixes the content of the higher order thought expressed. There need be no additional episodic thought. The higher order state literally depends on, causally depends on, the expression of the speech act. The perfect example is a situation in which I become aware of a deep attitude of mine when, in a totally unexpected way, without any premeditation, I simply blurt something out. Dennett himself refers to the famous passage from one of Bertrand Russell's letters to Lady Ottoline, in which he recalls the circumstances of his declaration of love to her. "I did not know I loved you till I heard myself telling you so. For one instant I thought, 'Good God, what have I said?' And then I knew it was the truth." For Dennett, this is not an exceptional feature, but the basic mechanism which generates a meaning. A word or a phrase forces itself upon us and thereby imposes a semblance of narrative order on our confused experience. There is no pre-existing deep awareness expressed in this phrase. It is, on the contrary, this very phrase which organizes our experience into a deep awareness. In literature, an outstanding example is provided by the very last lines of Patricia Highsmith's Strangers on a Train. In contrast to Hitchcock's film version, Guy does also kill Brunos's father, and at the end of the novel, the detectives, who have been closely monitoring him for some time, finally approach him to take him in for questioning. Guy, who has been preparing for this moment for a long time and has memorized his alibi in detail, reacts with a confessionary gesture of surrender which takes even him by surprise. Guy tried to speak and said something entirely different from what he had intended. "Take me." Again, Dennett's point would be that it is wrong to substantialize the attitude expressed in Guy's last words, as if deep within himself, he was all the time aware of his guilt and nourished the desire to be arrested and punished for it. There was, of course, a confessional disposition in Guy, but it was competing with other dispositions, ambiguous, not clearly defined, and it won out due to a concrete contingent constellation. Not unlike Kieslowski's early film Blind Chance, 1981, which deals with three different outcomes of a man running for a train. He catches it and becomes a communist official. He misses it and becomes a dissident. There is no train and he settles down to a mundane life. This notion of mere chance determining the course of a man's life was unable to both communists and dissidents. It deprives the dissident's attitude of its deep moral foundation. The point is that in all the three cases, the contingency which gave the spin to his life is repressed. That is, the hero constructs his life story as a narrative leading to its final result. A dissident, an ordinary man, a communist apparatchik. With a deep necessity. Is this not what Lacan referred to as the future anterior of the unconscious which will have been? In Hegel's own time, this properly dialectical self-relating, in which meaning emerges through the retroactive influence of its expression, was formulated in an unsurpassable way by Heinrich von Kleist in his essay on the gradual formation of thought in the process of speech. From 1805, first published posthumously in 1878, which deserves to be quoted in full. The French say, "L'appétit vient en mangeant," and this empirical maxim remains true if one makes a parody of it and says, "L'idée vient en parlant." Often I sit over my pages, over my papers, and I try to find out from what angle a given conflict has to be judged. Usually I look into the light as the brightest spot I can find as I try to enlighten my inner being. Or else I seek out the first approach, the first equation which expresses the obtaining relations and from which the solution may be derived simply through plain arithmetic. And look what happens as soon as I talk to my sister who is sitting and working behind me about this matter, I realize what hours of hard thinking have not been able to make clear to me. It isn't as if she was telling me in any direct sense. She does not know the law and has never studied her Euler and her Kästner. Neither is that what she leads me to the crucial point through deft questions, although this latter case may occasionally occur. But since I have some vague thoughts that are in some way connected with what I am looking for, then once I have embarked on the formulation of the thought, it is as if the need to lead what has been begun to some conclusion transforms my hazy imaginations into complete clarity in such a way that my insight is completely together with my rambling sentence. I mix in inarticulate noises, I draw out my sentence connectives, I use appositions where they are not strictly necessary, and I use other rhetorical tricks that will draw out speech. In this way, I gain the time to fabricate my idea in this workshop of reason. Nothing in all this is more useful than some movement on the part of my sister, a movement indicating that she intends to interrupt me. For my strained mind becomes even more excited by the need to defend this inherent right to speak against attack from the outside. The mind's abilities grow like those of a great general who is faced with a very difficult situation. It is against this background that I understand how useful Molière found his maid, for if, as he claims, he trusted her judgment more than his own, this would indicate a degree of modesty on his part which I refuse to believe was there. The other person's face is a curious source of inspiration for a person who speaks. A single glance which indicates that a half-expressed thought is already understood bestows on us the other half of the formulation. I believe that many a great orator, before he opened his mouth, did not know what he was going to say. But the conviction that the necessary wealth of thought would be naturally inspired by the conditions surrounding his speech and his resulting excitement causes him to be bold enough to make a beginning with his speech. This makes me think of that thunderbolt of Mirabeau. Mirabeau sent the master of ceremonies packing when the latter, after the last national meeting led by the king on June 23rd, in which the king had ordered the members of the assembly to disperse, returned to the meeting room where the assembly had not dispersed, and asked whether they had received the king's orders. "Yes," Mirabeau replied, "we have understood the king's orders." I am convinced that when he made this humane start, he did not think of those bayonets with which he closed his speech. "Yes, sir," he repeated, "we have understood them." One can see that he has no idea of where he is going. "However, on what authority do you think you are entitled?" he continues, and a sudden source of amazing thoughts began to flow for him, to address orders to us. "We are the representatives of the nation." Ah, this was what he needed. The nation gives orders. It does not receive orders. And he surges up the height of hubris. "And to make everything perfectly plain to you," and only at this point he finds the proper expression for the act of defiance for which his soul is prepared, "you should go and tell your king that we shall not leave our places here except when forced with bayonets," upon which he settled, utterly satisfied, into a chair. Thinking about the master of ceremonies, it is impossible to visualize him except in a state of complete spiritual bankruptcy. The law is the same as that by which an electrically neutral body, when entering the atmosphere of a charged body, will acquire the opposite, negative, bankrupt electrical charge. And just as the energy charge in the charged body is strengthened through interaction, so in the case of this annihilation of the opponent, Mirabeau's enthusiasm knew no bounds. Perhaps it was just the twitching of the upper lip or an ambiguously uncertain movement about the sleeves that caused the change of the course of events in France. One reads that Mirabeau stood up as soon as the master of ceremonies had left and proposed that the assembly should constitute itself as the National Assembly and as inviolable. For since he had lost his charge, like a Clystian bottle, he had become neutralized, and he gave room in his mind to fear of the judiciary at Châtelet and to carefulness in political action. This is a curious convergence between the phenomena of the natural and the moral world, which, if one wished to pursue the matter, could be shown to apply even in the minor subplots of this episode. But I shall leave my simile and I shall return to my subject. Even La Fontaine gives a very fine example of the gradual constitution of thought in the process of speaking in his fable entitled Les animaux malades de la peste. In this fable, the fox is forced to give a speech in defense of the lion without knowing where on earth he should find support for his defense. The well-rounded idea is born from a beginning which is dictated by necessity. The fable is well known. The plague is ravaging the animal kingdom. The lion assembles the important animals and explains that it must be offered heaven with a sacrifice in order to get it to relent. The lion maintained that there were many sinners amongst the animals, and the greatest of these would have to be sacrificed for the survival of the others. He therefore suggested that everyone should confess their sins to him. He, for his part, had to admit that in the heat of hunger he had killed many a sheep and even some dogs who had come too close. Moreover, he had once, by chance, in a gourmet mode, feasted on a shepherd. If no one else could show greater weaknesses, he was ready to die. "Sir," said the fox, who was trying to avert disaster from himself, "you are too generous. Your honest endeavor leads you too far. What's wrong with strangling a sheep or a dog, worthless creature? And then, quant à berger," he continues, "for this is the main point, on peut dire, although he has no idea what to say about him, qu'il méritait tout mal. He says that on the off chance that he can think of something, and now he is in trouble. Etant," he continues, "a poor phrase to use, but it does give him time, de ces gens-là," and only at this point does he hit that thought which gets him out of trouble. Qui sur les animaux se font un chimérique empire. And now for the demonstration that the ass, the bloodthirsty one who eats away at the herbs, that the ass was the proper sacrificial victim. And everyone pounces on the ass, tears him to pieces. Such speech is truly taught in the vocal medium. The sequences of thoughts and expressions go alongside each other, and the underlying psychological realities converge. Language, under these conditions, is not maniacless. It is not like some impediment on the wheel of the spirit. Language is a second wheel on the same axle. The situation is quite different if the mind is finished already with a thought before the speaking starts. When the spirit stays back in the process of mere articulation, and this business of articulation, far from exciting the spirit, on the contrary, reduces the mental intensity. If therefore a thought is expressed in a fuzzy way, then it does not at all follow that this thought was conceived in a confused way. On the contrary, it's quite possible that the ideas that are expressed in the most confusing fashion are the ones that were thought out most clearly. One often sees in social company where congenial conversation inspires everyone with continuous fresh ideas, that people who usually feel linguistically inept feel inspired to break into flickering of unstable articulation, to take hold of language and produce something utterly incomprehensible. And when these people have the others' attention, they show through their embarrassed gestures that they have no idea what they were really trying to say. It is quite probable that these people have thought up something quite apt and clear, but the abrupt change in activity, the passage of the mind from thinking to articulation, this abrupt change dampened that very excitement which was necessary for keeping the thought in mind as well as for putting it into words. In such cases, it is all the more necessary that language is available to us with facility and ease, so that what we have just taught and are unable to articulate at that very same time can at least be put into words as soon as possible afterwards. Quite generally, someone who with the same degree of clarity speaks faster than his opponent will have a distinct advantage over him. The reason is that the fast talker is leading more troops into the field. When, in examinations, one abruptly examines open-minded and well-educated people without introduction on questions like what is the state or what is property, one realizes how necessary it is that the mind be excited in a certain way for us to be able to recreate in our minds even thoughts that we have had before. If the same people whom we examine in this way are found in congenial company where the talk has been about questions of the state and of property for a while, then perhaps these people would have no trouble through comparisons, contrasts, and summary of the concepts concerned to find acceptable definitions. But under examination conditions, where the preparation of the mind is missing, one finds that they falter. Only an ignorant examiner will conclude that they do not know. For it is not we who know, it is a certain state of us that knows. Only truly vulgar spirits, people who have learned by heart yesterday that the state is supposed to be, and who have forgotten it tomorrow, will have a ready answer. Perhaps there is no more inappropriate occasion to show oneself in a positive light than a public examination. I disregard the fact that public examinations are disgusting and hurtful to the sensitive mind. I disregard the fact that it is provoking to be faced with a hack who looks at our knowledge in order to decide whether to buy us if the number is 5 and to send us away if the number is 6. It is very hard to play on the instrument of the human mind, to elicit its proper sound from it. The mind gets so easily out of tune under clumsy hands, so much so that the great connoisseur of men, the consummate specialist in the midwifery of thoughts, as Kant calls it, might well commit serious mistakes with the young soul entrusted to him. What ensures good results for such young people, by the way, even the most ignorant among them, is the circumstance that the examiner's mind, in the case of public examinations, are far too preoccupied to be able to pass a free judgment. Not only do they often feel the indecency of the whole procedure, it would be indecent enough to ask someone to open his purse before our eyes, but how much more indecent it is to ask him to open up his soul for examination. There is another thing. The examiners themselves have to pass a severe test in these examinations, and they may often thank the Lord for being able to leave examinations without showing weaknesses that are greater, perhaps, than those disclosed in the youth that has just emerged from the university and whom they have examined. Kleist thus inverts the common wisdom, according to which one should open one's mouth and say something only when one has a clear idea of what wants to say. If therefore a thought is expressed in a fuzzy way, then it does not at all follow that this thought was conceived in a confused way. On the contrary, it's quite possible that the ideas that are expressed in the most confusing fashion are the ones that were thought out most clearly. Let us return to his comment on the famous episode from the French Revolution, which occurred on June 23, 1789, when the king ordered the members of the assembly to disperse and then left. The members refused to leave, so the king sent the master of ceremonies back to the assembly, asking the members whether they had received the king's orders. "Yes," Mirabeau replied, "we have understood the king's orders. I am convinced that when he made this humane start, he did not think of those bayonets with which he closed his speech." "Yes, sir," he repeated, "we have understood them. One can see that he has no idea of where he is going. However, on what authority do you think you are entitled?" he continues, and a sudden source of amazing thoughts began to flow for him, "to address orders to us. We are the representatives of the nation." Ah, this was what he needed. The nation gives orders, it does not receive orders, and it surges up the heights of hubris. And to make everything perfectly plain to you, and only at this point he finds the proper expression for the act of defiance for which his soul is prepared, you should go and tell your king that we shall not leave our places here except when forced with bayonets, upon which he settled utterly satisfied into a chair. What Kleist makes clear is the presence in the Hegelian space of another Ver, which supplements the Freudian list of Vers, Verdrängung, Verneinung, Verwerfung, the Ver of Versprechen, of saying more than one wanted to say. Is not the same mechanism, the same panicky reversal from impasse into pass, at work in many legendary revolutionary gestures? In a famous speech in Assemblée Nationale, Robespierre claimed that there were traitors of the revolution even in the very hall, and then went on, I say that anyone who trembles at this moment is guilty, for innocence never fears public scrutiny. We can imagine his reasoning. After the first statement, he noticed signs of unrest and fear among the listeners. He quickly thought about how to exploit this fear. Should he offer a carrot by adding something like, if you are innocent, you have nothing to fear? No, better to use this fear itself as an argument for guilt. Perhaps the same goes for the late Lenin's programmatic note. What if the complete hopelessness of the situation, by stimulating the efforts of the workers and peasants tenfold, offered us the opportunity to create the fundamental requisites of civilization in a different way from that of the West European countries? After conceding the complete hopelessness of the situation in which the Bolshevik state found itself in 1922, with no realistic option of building socialism, Lenin thought in panic about how to block the obvious conclusion that the Bolsheviks should simply step down, and suddenly the idea came to him of presenting this hopeless situation itself as offering an unexpected opportunity. There is a passage in one of Stalin's speeches from the early 1930s where he proposes radical measures against all those who even secretly oppose the collectivization of farms. We should detect and fight without mercy even those who oppose collectivization only in their thoughts. Yes, I mean this, we should fight even people's thoughts. One can safely presume that this passage was not prepared in advance. Stalin got caught up in his rhetorical enthusiasm and was spontaneously carried away into adding that even people's private thoughts should be controlled and fought. Then he immediately became aware of what he had just said, but instead of admitting that he had gotten carried away, quickly decided to stick heroically to his hyperbole. Looking further back, does not exactly the same hold for Antigone's confrontation with Creon. At the outset, Antigone grounds her insistence on the proper burial of Polynices in the simple substantial ethical awareness that there are higher, or rather deeper, laws than the public laws of the city. It is only through her act that she becomes aware of the specific motive that guided her. She was ready to do what she did only for her brother, not for all the oppressed and excluded. Mirabeau and Antigone, two exemplary cases of how truth is an effect of surprise triggered by its enunciation, or as Althusser put it, referring to the word play between prise and surprise. Every authentic grasping, prise, of some content comes as a surprise to the one who accomplishes it. Althusser locates this insight in the same Kierkegaardian opposition between the open contingent process of becoming and the retroactive systemic illusion. The world is an accomplished fact. Once it is accomplished, sense, etc., take over in it, but the accomplishment of the fact is an effect of contingency. The irony is that for Althusser as for Kierkegaard, Hegel is the systemic philosopher of the fait accompli, while, as we have just seen, The point of the Hegelian dialectical analysis is not to reduce the chaotic flow of events to a deeper necessity, but to unearth the contingency of the rise of necessity itself. This is what it means to grasp things in their becoming. So when, in his late text, The Subterranean Current of the Materialism of Encounter, Althusser endeavors to discern, beneath the hegemonic idealist orientation of origins/sense, etc., the subterranean tradition of aleatory materialism. Epicurus and the Stoics versus Plato, Machiavelli versus Descartes, Spinoza versus Kant, and Hegel, Marx, Heidegger. The least one can say is that he is wrong to locate Hegel in the hegemonic idealist line. Everything is thus here in Christ's refined description, up unto and including the temporal dialectic of transference and the proto-Lacanian invocation of the cut, the analyst's sudden intervention, into the flow of analysans's rambling, free associations, as generative of the sudden emergence of new meaning. Nothing in all this is more useful than some movement on the part of my sister, a movement indicating that she intends to interrupt me. For my strained mind becomes even more excited by the need to defend this inherent right to speak against attack from the outside. It is easy to miss the complexity of Kleist's point. It is not simply that the effort to put one's thought into words clarifies and forms it, but that for this to happen, my speech should be addressed to a big other who, in the transferential illusion, is presupposed to already know the meaning I struggle to formulate. In order to formulate a thought, we must presuppose that this thought already exists in the big other's mind. The other person's face is a curious source of inspiration for a person who speaks. A single glance, which indicates that a half-expressed thought is already understood, bestows on us the other half of the formulation. This, then, brings us back to Hegel. The structure of the Hegelian dialectical process is not the automatic deployment of consequences regulated by an inexorable conceptual necessity, but precisely the process of getting lost and then improvising an invention described by Kleist. One plans to say, do something, things go wrong, one gets lost, and to escape the deadlock, one invents an improvised solution. And one should go to the end here. Does not exactly the same hold for the crucifixion itself? Christ's plan was to give himself up to the Roman authorities via the delicate negotiations carried out by Judas. However, things took an unexpected turn for the worse. And, in a truly Kleistian twist, as a desperate attempt to get something out of the fiasco, the story of redemption through death was duly concocted. And, in exactly the same way, it was only Creon's interruption which made Antigone aware of her true intention. There is, however, a limitation in this figure of the brother as a stand-in for the universality of a human being deserving funeral rites. The brother, as big other, is deprived of all personal features for Antigone's deed, no longer concerns the living but the dead. The individual who, after a long succession of deaths of separate, disconnected experiences, concentrates himself into a single, completed shape, and has raised himself out of the unrest of the accidents of life into the calm of simple universality. Spaeth is right to add wryly that to love someone for what he is, for his being, is to love him in his inaction, is to love a corpse. This limitation is the necessary result of Antigone's immediate immersion in the ethical substance. There is no call of duty here exerting pressure on us, so that in order to act upon it, we have to fight our spontaneous pathological impulses. Antigone's pathos is directly substantially ethical. This is why, as Hegel puts it, experiencing the limited character of this ethical identity can only happen through suffering. In experiencing the contingency of this identity, the subject has to separate itself from its very ethical nature. However, in an exemplarily Hegelian way, this utter tragedy, this loss of our very ethical ground, turns into comedy. In other words, Hegel noticed something weird happening to Antigone after she pathetically assumes her fate. To put it bluntly, she starts to act, for her statements display a level of self-awareness and reflexivity about her role which undermine her immediate ethical spontaneity from within. I've heard about a guest of ours, daughter of Tantalus from Phrygia. She went on to an excruciating death in Sipylus, right on the mountain peak. The stone there, just like clinging ivy, wore her down, and now, so people say, the snow and rain never leave her there, as she laments. Below her weeping eyes, her neck is wet with tears. God brings me to a final rest which most resembles hers. Antigone is using metaphors to designate herself. Do not these lines display a self-consciously artistic ability involved in playing the role of a character? Antigone is acting here, modeling her predicament on mythical examples. In short, she is aware of the imminent theatricality of her tragic predicament, a theatricality which by definition confers on it a minimal touch of comedy. One can and should imagine her interrupting her pathetic complaint, worrying briefly whether her outbursts of spontaneous passion is well acted. Indeed, the tragic characters are artists who do not express with unconscious naturalness and naivete the external aspect of their resolves and enterprises, as happens in the language accompanying ordinary actions in actual life. On the contrary, they give utterance to the inner essence, they prove the rightness of their action, and the pathos which moves them is soberly asserted and definitely expressed in its universal individuality, free from the accidents of circumstance and personal idiosyncrasies. The lesson concerns the inherent theatricality involved in self-knowledge and action. No action or motivation of the agent is directly his own, but must be assessed in the light of others' reactions to it. He understands himself by constantly looking at his actions in the light of the mask that he wears in them. In other words, the lesson concerns the mediation of desire and feeling by the imagination or fiction inherent in the relation between actor and spectator, namely the inherently socially mediated character of desire formation itself. What Lacan calls the big other is this agency of social rules and appearances which confers on everything we do a minimal aspect of theatricality. No matter how passionately we act, our desire is always a desire of the other, mediated by the other, the symbolic texture which provides the scripts for possible desires. We are not directly ourselves, we play the role of ourselves, we imitate a fiction of what we are. We should link this topic with Hegel's lectures on aesthetics, where he describes how the passage from tragedy to comedy concerns overcoming the limits of representation. While in a tragedy the individual actor represents the universal character he plays, in a comedy he immediately is this character. The gap of representation is thus closed, which, however, does not mean that in a comedy the actor coincides with the person he plays in the way that he plays himself on the stage, that there he just is what he really is. It is rather that, in a properly Hegelian way, the gap which separates the actor from his stage persona in a tragedy is transposed into the stage persona itself. A comic character is never fully identified with his role. He always retains the ability to observe himself from outside, making fun of himself. Speight notices the inversion of theatricality that occurs in modernity. When the alienating process of Bildung reaches its climax, in ancient comedy it was the recognition of real life coming onto the stage that was at issue in the comic actor's dropping of his mask, whereas here we will be concerned with how the theatrical comes into life. The artificial social world of modernity confronts us with roles and imitation in social life itself. This reversal is in itself deeply dialectical. The intrusion of reality onto the stage, an actor distancing himself from his role, showing his awareness of playing a role, is paid for by the theatricalization of real life itself. You start claiming that we should not get caught up in the theatrical fiction, that we should be aware of how theater is part of our real lives, and you end up claiming that real life itself is a theater.